Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. I'm Daniel McAdams, your host. Dr. Paul is traveling today, so he's not in the studio. But today we're going to be helped out in our efforts to have a good look at President Trump's address to the UN General Assembly by an old friend of ours who's been on the show many times, former career CIA officer, prolific writer, Phil Giraldi. Phil, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us, Phil. It's always great to get your insights, and I'm sure you were glued to the TV watching President Trump give his speech yesterday to the UN. It was fascinating in parts. It started out with some unexpected laughs. He was unexpected because I don't know how you felt, Phil, but he seemed to approach it as like a car salesman, you know, about how great things were doing. And everyone just thought it was funny. And I think he sort of in a moment of self-reflection thought it sounded a little funny as well. Did you have that sort of lighthearted feel at first, Phil?
Yeah, I had this impression as he got launched into his theme that basically what we were seeing was a midterm election appeal to his voter base. I mean, basically it was all about how wonderful things are, how this may be the greatest administration in the history of the United States. How the economy is booming, how all those jobs are coming back from Asia, and all this other stuff. And of course, that kind of rhetoric is quite comic.
Yeah, and it was greeted that way. But you know, I did get to feel watching it and then reading the speech afterward. I don't know, Phil, how you felt. I sort of felt I was living in a different universe. So that's why I gave you a call and wondered if we might get together and just take apart a few of the things, kind of like Trump's world in our world. And I know this is true about you as well, Phil, unlike a lot of the people who have a ambivalent feeling toward President Trump, ours is not a blind hatred. You know, ours is simply confined to policy, confined to whether he does what he said he was going to do. So I think that we can critique it within that perspective. And it really did feel, Phil, like a different world. But I want to start off on the bright side. I want to start off on the positive side. So let's talk a little bit about Korea. And he's taking a lot of credit for Korea. And he's got a good point. We're not toe-to-toe. We're not firing missiles at each other, as he pointed out. How much credit do you think he gets for this, Phil?
Well, I think, you know, again, this was essentially talking to his base. He wanted to show that he is the man in foreign policy and that by his management style, which is to go toe-to-toe with the hard guys, this succeeded. And as a result, his good friend in North Korea is now ready to do the right things. You know, I think it was a lot of that. Obviously, it's the reality is somewhat less dramatic than that. The really very little of anything has come out of the one-to-one talk they had. The Pentagon is complaining. The State Department is complaining about North Korean behavior and their compliance with whatever agreements were already reached, if there were any. So it was a bit of a con job, but it's understandable.
Yeah, and everything that we've seen, they almost sound like the U.S. is standing in the way. They don't want them to rebuild their train connections. We don't want them to get too far ahead of it. We don't want them to freeze us out of the game. So it's almost like, okay, if he wants to take credit for it, that's great, as long as it keeps moving forward. But the other thing, Phil, and this stood out, and I commented on it on Twitter because it just seemed so bizarre, and I'm going to read it. If you don't mind, I'm sure you probably read this and thought about it and maybe you laughed and maybe scratched your head. But he's talking about sovereignty and how wonderful America is about protecting the sovereignty of others. He said, "We believe that when nations respect the rights of their neighbors and defend interests of their people, they can better work together to secure the blessings of safety, prosperity, and peace." He went on to say, "Each of us here today is the emissary of a distinct culture, a rich history, and a people bound together by ties of memory, tradition, and the values that make our homelands like nowhere else on earth." Okay. "That is why America will always choose independence and cooperation over global governance, control, and domination." Okay, that sounds good. "I honor the right of every nation in this room to pursue its own customs, beliefs, and traditions. The United States will not tell you how to live, work, or worship. We only ask that you honor our sovereignty in return." Very poetic words, Phil, but it's hard to read that with a straight face.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, you have to put it in the context of the one subject he talked about at greatest length in the speech was Iran. And he made some very odd comments about sovereignty in the context of Iran being a country that doesn't respect other people's sovereignty. I mean, the reality of what's going on in the Middle East is that we are the country and Israel, we are the two that are not respecting the sovereignty of Syria. Iran is in Syria by invitation and does respect its sovereignty. So there's a bit, again, if you figure he's talking to his audience, he wants to say nice things about the way things are not in the United States. This is pretty much what he's doing. He wants to say on one hand, we're all different. It's almost like a Monty Python sketch. We're all different, but at the same time, we're all the same. We're going to cooperate, and we're not going to do it because we're bullying you, but because it's in your best interest. Well, of course, we know that's a lie.
Yeah, indeed. And you touched on Iran, so let's jump to that. Of course, it's got the heavy Iran rhetoric, the heavy anti-Iran rhetoric. Every solution to the humanitarian crisis in Syria must also include a strategy to address the brutal regime that has fueled and financed it, the corrupt dictatorship in Iran. I mean, that is just bizarre. Come on, Phil. I mean, what are they smoking when they're writing these speeches? How is it that Iran fueled and financed the bloodshed in Syria? We know that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. I mean, Syria was a sovereign nation paying its own bills before we introduced the Syria Accountability Act in 2003. That's when the pressure on Syria for change started to come. And Iran doesn't have the kind of resources to keep a country like Syria floating, if that were even indeed its intention. So the whole argument is ridiculous. It's and he goes on, of course, to say other things about Iran, about how they're the source of all terrorism, greatest source of terrorism in the world. These are, interestingly enough, of course, these are the same lines that were used with Saddam.
Yeah, and that brings me to a question I wanted to ask you, Phil. Your career has been as a counterterrorism expert. You know about terrorism. You worked in it for decades. Let's talk about this claim. Iran is the world's leading sponsor of terrorism. What do you think about that?
This is a claim that, as I say, this is a historic claim. You have to say this about the bad guys, because after 9/11. People who are supporting terrorism allegedly are outside the pale. Well, in the case of Iran, what they're really referring to is its relationship with Hezbollah. Hezbollah started out as a, I'm not so sure terrorist group is exactly right. It was a resistance against the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon. And naturally, the Israelis and the United States refer to that as terrorism. It is now basically a political party in Lebanon, and indeed it's a minority political party. It's Shia Muslims are less than a quarter of the population. The biggest group in Lebanon continues to be Christian. So it's not exactly like Lebanon is controlled by Iran, which is the implication of a lot of this. And if you want to look at who is supporting terrorism in the Middle East, you have to look at Israel and the United States. Israel is directly supporting terrorists because they want chaos in Syria. The United States is doing so because the U.S. has to have terrorists active in Syria to continue to stay there. So it's kind of silly arguments both ways.
And we both remember, Phil, back in 2014 when President Obama announced that he was going to take some military action in Iraq and Syria, because a small religious minority was trapped on a hillside. Remember the Yazidis, and this is the whole justification. And then it morphed. Then it was the Khorasan group. Then it morphed into ISIS. All of these continuing reasons and justifications for the U.S. to remain. Well, President Trump did give us a little good news that we already knew, but that's okay. He said, "I'm pleased to report that the bloodthirsty killers known as ISIS have been driven out from the territory they once held in Iraq and Syria." So ISIS is gone, but hold on, that was the justification for the U.S. being involved in Syria, violating the sovereignty of Syria. So what is going on now? You probably saw that John Bolton, national security advisor, gave a speech, I think it was on Monday, where he introduced and our friend Todd Pierce sent this to us just before we came on, introduced a whole, it says a mission creep on steroids it is in Syria. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit, Phil.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, here you have the president claiming that ISIS is the reason why we're there. And indeed, Mattis at the Pentagon yesterday said the same thing. He said the mission hasn't changed. He said the mission is to engage and defeat ISIS. That is our mission. But Bolton is saying something different. And also Jeffries, the special reporter for Syria, State Department, they're saying something quite different, that the United States has to stay in Syria to basically get rid of Iran, get Iran out of the country and make sure Iran does not come back. And that includes Iranian proxies, which they're referring to Hezbollah. So we're getting mixed messages on this. And the consensus view of those of us who are cynical about the whole process is that these arguments are being made basically to allow the U.S. to stay in Syria indefinitely. And by the way, ISIS has not been defeated in either Syria or more dangerous in some ways in Iraq. And it has also extended its reach into Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yeah, I've got some messages from people in Afghanistan that are concerned about the U.S. exporting these ISIS fighters. We do know that they let them go from, was it Deir Ezzer? Some ISIS fighters escaped from Raqqa. But here's a quote from Bolton. Talk about a shift. He said on Monday, we're not going to leave in Syria as long as Iranian troops are outside Iranian borders. And that includes Iranian proxies and militias. It's a pretty remarkable talk about taking a policy and making it your own. It's amazing. And you're right. It's often, Phil, these people behind the scenes that are not top shelf names. We know everyone knows Bolton and all these guys. But this fellow Jeffries, what do you know about him?
Well, Jeffries was a U.S. ambassador. I don't remember where. I think it was somewhere in the Arab world. And he seemed, perfectly normal, conservative kind of State Department type. But after he retired from the State Department, he got a job with WINEP. Now, WINEP is a spinoff of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And he basically became a shill on Capitol Hill for Israeli interests. And now this guy is the reporter, the senior official running our Syrian policy and coming out with lines that basically derive from John Bolton. And John Bolton, of course, is well known to be an Israel advocate. And also he's tied to Iranian resistance groups like Mujahideen Khalq. So you have an interesting series of connections here, all of which, I would point out, has nothing to do with the United States. There is not an interest of a genuine interest of the United States in any of this mess.
Yeah, it's interesting. Someone like him, he's not on the radar screen, but he's like a kid in a candy store. He's operating under the radar and pushing his agenda, and it doesn't have very much to do with ISIS. You're pointed out correctly. And as while we're on the subject of the MEK, there's the issue of Rudy Giuliani, who was President Trump's personal lawyer, giving another paid speech to this organization. They, as you know, they've been involved in terrorism for a number of decades. This on the day of a terrorist attack in Iran, which killed women and children. Here's Giuliani speaking to a terror group, picking up a big paycheck. So the idea is Iran being accused of being a terrorist government, which it's not. The U.S. isn't actually supporting an actual terrorist group to take over in Iran. I mean, you can't make this up.
Yeah, no, you can't. And of course, Giuliani has been a big player in this. You go there, you speak for 20 minutes, and you get a $100,000 check.
Nice.
Elaine Chao is another one, the wife of our Senate majority leader.
Yeah.
And also, it should be pointed out that Bolton, when he was speaking on Monday or Tuesday, I'm not sure which day it was. I think it was actually yesterday, Tuesday. He was speaking in front of a group that's funded by Sheldon Adelson. It's called United Against Nuclear Iran. So
yeah.
Yeah, so that's who, where he was speaking. He received a handsome fee for doing so. So this, you know, this is if there's a conspiracy going on here, it's inside the U.S. government, and we are the ones that are playing the patsy on this whole thing.
Yeah, foreign policy for sale, right? Foreign experts for sale. Now, the other thing that we can't let pass without looking at this is, I don't know if you noticed this, Phil, but his discussion of the Yemen issue I thought was particularly disgusting. And I'm going to read a sentence from it. The UAE, which is United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar have pledged billions of dollars to aid the people of Syria and Yemen, and they're pursuing multiple avenues in ending Yemen's horrible, horrific civil war. They're making the Saudis and the UAE look like the good guys. They're doing everything they can to stop this war.
Yeah, that was possibly the most outrageous comment in the whole speech, because it runs completely contrary to the facts in the case, which is that essentially it's a genocide is being performed on the Yemenis by the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, with the United States aiding and assisting by supplying a lot of the weapons and also providing the political cover. Essentially, the United States is saying that these are rebels. These rebels are tied to Iran. That's basically essentially the argument. And because that's the case, then they're fair game. And this is ridiculous. They're blowing up school buses. There's cholera has appeared. There are food shortages. They won't let ships with food into the country at all. They blockaded it. This is as close to genocide as you're going to get in that part of the world. And yet Donald Trump or whoever is advising him, I would assume Steve Miller and John Bolton, have basically steered him in the wrong direction on this issue.
Yeah, talk about bombs for peace. Here's one thing I liked, Phil, and it made me optimistic that maybe you're going to get a phone call. He said, America's policy of principled realism means we will not be held hostage to old dogmas, discredited ideologies, and so-called experts who've been proven wrong over the years. So I'm half joking, but you know, what does that mean? These same experts are the people that are running as foreign policy, quote unquote, experts that have been so wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he really meant that, he'd be calling up you and Ron Paul. but he's not about to do that, I don't think. The fact is, you know, it's like, again, you mentioned the alternative universe, and that's sort of what it is. It's like they can't see what's right in front of them. And right in front of them, it's the same people that were here with George W. Bush, to a lesser extent with Barack Obama. But these are the neocons. They're basically staffing the second and third levels in the administration in national security and foreign policy. And of course, they've got their men in place at the top, and in terms of Bolton and Pompeo. So it's a frightening situation. And if you can't see that these guys are the establishment that has ruined everything, gotten everything wrong, then there's something wrong with your thinking.
Yeah, how do you think, I mean, stepping back, for how is it possible that these are the only experts in Washington? I mean, there are some relatively obscure people, you've named a few of them a while ago, who may not be on the tip of everyone's tongue. Well, what does it mean to be an expert? How are these people still in charge?
Well, the problem with Washington is that you spend enough time in Washington, everything is done by networking. And so if you get one neocon into a certain office at State Department or at Treasury or at the CIA or even in the Pentagon, suddenly you have 15 of them.
Yeah.
And it's because they work very hard at networking. They work very hard at bringing their people into the system. And that's how they accomplish this. And think of all the think tanks. I mean, the think tanks are the nurturing grounds of these people. These people come out of the think tanks. The think tanks are funded by neocon sources. Is essentially people who are strong on Israel, strong on defense, because that keeps the money flowing, defense contractors. So it's a self-feeding system.
It is, and you're absolutely right. You know, these people are ravenous when it comes to this, and they know what they're doing. I was in a situation once where there was an election. It was the election of 2000 before I was working on Capitol Hill, and I saw these groups going through the plumbook, it's called, as you know, Phil, where they're the list of thousands of jobs, thousands of political appointees. I saw them going through it and networking and getting their people. We can get this guy here, get this guy here. And it really is that overt. And it explains, you and I are scraping for a couple of dollars, and these guys are spending time, in these incredibly well-funded think tanks. So I guess they're the experts, and we're the dummies. We have to close it up, Phil, but one last question, one last thought. Just as before we went on, I was looking at the President Trump's speech to the UN Security Council today. Two of the things, if we can comment on, we're running out of time, but one thing, China is trying to interfere in our elections, he's claiming, and two, all options for Venezuela are on the table, quote, even strong ones. That's pretty concerning, especially when you talk about sovereignty.
Yeah, there's been considerable chatter about Venezuela, and as has been reported, Trump actually wanted to use military assets, military force, to somehow resolve the situation in Venezuela, which would have created an actual civil war. So it was not really a smart move. Unfortunately, he apparently was talked out of it. But that's still kind of on the table, and the whole issue that Venezuela is a problem for us to solve is just absolutely wrongheaded. I mean, it will only create a situation that's worse. Clearly, nobody on the Trump staff has any conception of how Latin America views U.S. interventions. and the China thing is the same thing. I mean, this is kind of, it's throwing something out there. One more reason to support the trade war, which is developing with China. It's a non sequitur. It doesn't really support the case. And where is the evidence? You still haven't come up with the evidence that the Russians actually influenced anything in the election.
Yeah, it's propaganda, bombast. Finding an enemy. It's all about that. It's all about keeping the Washington machine well oiled, well healed. Phil, I want to thank you so much for joining me and helping break down this speech. Hopefully we were able to highlight some of the top points, and we really appreciate your analysis, Phil.
Well, thank you for having me on. I always enjoy it.
Thanks. And I want to thank our audience for tuning in to the Ron Paul Liberty Report. Hope to see you again soon.